Okay, then thank you very much, everybody, for coming today. So here's our guest, Mr. Jeffrey Franks. Thank you very much for coming. Today's topic is economic convergence in the euro area, coming together or drifting apart, a very timely topic. Perhaps I will briefly introduce you, Mr. Franks, and then we go on with your presentation. So you have been with the IMF for 24 years, so you're a real veteran, I would say, of the fund. You currently run the IMF's Europe office. You are the resident representative to the EU, so you're very close contact with the European policymakers. However, you have also been missioned to Pakistan, to Ukraine, to Ecuador. You have run the local teams for France, Romania, Paraguay, and Belgium. And you hold a PhD from Harvard University and master's degree from Princeton and Oxford. And so we are very lucky and happy that you managed to come to the LSE today. You will speak for roughly 45 minutes, I heard, which will then be followed by questions and answers from you, hopefully. So if you want to tweet on this event, I would recommend that you use the hashtag LSE Euro so that you can actually share your thoughts on the event. I should also point out that there are podcasts. Most of our lectures are available as podcasts subsequently, so check out the website. And yeah, thank you very much for coming and for taking an interest.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much. Can you hear me on this mic? Yeah, you can hear me. I was telling the organizers I tend to wander when I talk, so I did want to have the mic, the portable mic as well. So I'm going to present to you some research that has been undertaken by the economists in the Brussels and Paris offices of the IMF over the last year or so on the issue of convergence. This research comes out of the fact that we were perceiving in Brussels in particular that this is an issue that is increasingly of concern to European policymakers. And so we thought if we did a little bit of digging into the whys and whats of convergence, it might contribute to the policy debate. And in fact, at the end of the presentation, we will have a little discussion of some potential policy recommendations to address the challenges of economic convergence. To begin with, I think we need to talk a little bit about the whys of the convergence challenge here. We are in a situation right now where the economy in Europe is recovering. We have just posted in 2017, the first year in nearly a decade, where all 28 members of the EU have positive economic growth. That's great news for Europe. It's a long time in coming. And not only is growth broader, but it's also stronger. We've revised up our forecasts for economic growth in the last two rounds of our World Economic Outlook, whereas previously for about 5 or 6 years we were consistently revising the future forecast down because we were overly optimistic about the recovery. So the recovery has gained strength, it's gained solidity, and it's broadened in its scope. But there are some long-term challenges that Europe is facing. And I'll just talk a little bit about productivity before I get into the convergence side of this discussion. The first question we ask ourselves when we want to look at convergence is, what do we mean by convergence? And there are, in the economics literature, several different ways of looking at convergence or different types of convergence. So when you see in the press a discussion of convergence, you're usually talking about income convergence. So are the incomes of the poorer countries in the EU approaching the incomes of the wealthier countries in the EU? Is there a narrowing of the gap between the wealthier and the poorer countries in Europe? And this is ultimately a question that is linked to productivity, so that's why I'll start out with a little bit of a discussion of that. The second possible discussion on convergence is what we would call nominal convergence, and that is mainly focused on nominal indicators like interest rates and inflation. In fact, those of you who know about the criteria, the Maastricht criteria for joining the euro, know that interest rates and inflation rates were two of the main criteria to join. You had to have convergence on those indicators before you could join the euro area. And the thinking here was that nominal convergence, interest rates that were more similar, and inflation rates that were more similar were absolutely necessary for a single central bank to be able to manage monetary policy. Because if you have a huge diversion of interest rates, then interest rate policy becomes more complicated. If inflation rates are widely dispersant, then you would have a problem of deciding whether inflation is too high or too low, because it's too high in some places and perhaps too low in others. From an economic theory point of view, the key aspect of convergence is, in fact, cyclical convergence. And here the argument related to the literature on the optimal currency areas is essentially the following. What you need for a common monetary policy is that countries be in the same phase of the economic cycle at the same time, because the central bank ultimately has to decide whether to raise interest rates, lower interest rates, or leave interest rates the same. And if some countries are in the upswing of their economic cycle, while others are in the downswing of their economic cycle, that would make the problem of common monetary policy extremely difficult. So from a theoretical point of view, this has been one of the main concerns about convergence. Now, added to the traditional business cycle convergence, there's a recently emerging economic literature looking at a separate but related phenomenon, which is called financial cycles. So there are cycles of credit growth and credit shrinkage of real estate prices and real estate price declines that can determine a financial cycle, which is related to but independent of the economic cycle itself. And one of the things we look at in this paper is whether or not there has been convergence of those financial cycles, because that could also be important from the point of view of the governance of monetary policy. And finally, there's the issue of structural convergence. I'm not that comfortable with the term structural convergence, although some people in Brussels do use this term, suggesting that there should be a convergence of economic structures among the European member states. My view is, rather than convergence, the optimal word here would be structural flexibility, because it doesn't actually matter if you have exactly the same economic structure. In fact, we would never want that to be the case. But what we need to have is structures of economies that are sufficiently flexible to deal with the possibility of asymmetric shocks, so that when you are not in the same part of your economic cycle, you can absorb those differences through the structural flexibility of the economy. So what's happening on the real convergence side is rooted in what's happening on the productivity side. This chart illustrates the differences of economic performance among major euro area member states in recent years. And what you can see is that beginning with the economic crisis, there has been a wide divergence between some of the major countries. You see, on the one hand, German economic growth reattained its pre-crisis level in about 2010, 2011, and has been growing relatively robustly since then. On the other extreme, Italy, which is the yellow line here, has reached its economic, the bottom of its economic downturn in 2013, and has only recently begun to grow positively, and is yet several years away from reapproaching the GDP level that it had in 2007 or 2008. And in between, of course, there is France and Spain. Spain is an interesting case because the decline in Spain was long-lasting and sharp, sharper than in the other cases, but the recovery has also been much sharper, and Spain has now reattained its pre-crisis level. So you have a series of different types of economic performance: relatively shallow downturn, robust growth; a relatively shallow downturn, less robust growth in the case of France; a sharp downturn with not much recovery at all in the case of Italy; and a sharp downturn but with a sharp recovery in the case of Spain. These economic performance gaps are illustrations or manifestations of differences in productivity growth. And here, if you look at total factor productivity growth, we're indexing to the year 2000, what you can see is that there's been a wide dispersion of productivity performance among Eurozone countries. On the upper side, German productivity is about 10 percentage points higher than it was in 2000, by 2018, we're projecting. And France is at about 5% above. It's very hard to see, but there's a little white line which represents the Eurozone average, which is about where France is. And then on the other side, we have Spain, where productivity actually declined, but is now rebounding back above the initial level. And Italy, where productivity remains lower than it was before the crisis. So when we look at why these countries have diverged in economic performance, this is a big part of the explanation. There's been a divergence in productivity performance. Now, I should also note, for those of you who follow productivity studies, that even this 110 level that Germany has attained over a period of 18 years is very slow total factor productivity growth by historical standards. And there is a worldwide concern that total factor productivity growth, not just in Europe but also in the US and elsewhere, is not growing as quickly as it did before. And so even this performance of Germany by historical standards is a relatively weak one. Here's another slide which disaggregates this economic performance into its different components. So what we've done here is we've divided the countries of the Eurozone into two groups: high productivity initial productivity countries and low initial productivity countries. In the low initial productivity countries, we have Spain, Italy, Greece, and Portugal. And then in the high productivity set of countries, we have Austria, Belgium, Finland, France, Germany, Ireland, and the Netherlands. And what we can see here are some very interesting phenomena. The first was that, obviously, high productivity growth was greater in high productivity countries than it was in low productivity countries. It's not just that they had a better productivity starting point, they also have a better first derivative. They're growing more quickly. But in addition to that, we can see that in the early period, 1990 to 1999, the gap wasn't huge in those growth rates. And the growth rates were a bit differently composed. There was a total productivity gap, but that was partially compensated by greater investment, greater growth of capital, which is the hashed line, the gray one here. So we have a slightly lower growth in the low productivity countries, but the low total factor productivity is partially compensated by greater investment. And in both cases, there isn't much contribution from labor because the labor forces weren't growing very rapidly. As we move through time, we see productivity going down and growth going down in both sets of countries. But the decline in the low productivity set of countries is much greater. And this is what is striking. If you look at 2008 to 2016, for the set of low productivity countries, what you in fact see is negative growth, which is composed of a very small positive contribution from investment, which, by the way, investment has not yet recovered in the Eurozone to its pre-crisis levels. And a negative contribution of labor force decline, labor force participation declines, and a negative contribution from total factor productivity. Whereas in the high initial productivity countries, you still have a positive contribution from total factor productivity, which is in some sense canceling out the negative contribution of labor force population aging and that sort of thing. So the gap between the high productivity and the low productivity countries actually widened during that period. There has been some adjustment in the countries that have been undergoing these difficult adjustments. And what you can see in this chart is relative unit labor costs in some of those low productivity countries versus Germany. And what you can see is that there was a sharp deterioration in the competitiveness of Spain, Greece, and Italy, and to a lesser extent Portugal, in the boom years running up to the crisis, while German unit labor costs were actually declining. So productivity in Germany was rising faster than wages. Productivity in Italy was growing slower than wages. And in fact, wage growth in the two countries was quite similar. The difference was productivity. And that was opening a competitiveness gap between Italy and Germany. With the adjustment programs and with the own adjustments and reforms implemented by some of these countries, we have seen relative unit labor costs decline in Spain, Greece, Italy, and Portugal. Although the decline in Italy is not as significant as that decline that we've seen in those countries that had adjustment programs during the crisis, where there's been a much sharper decline. But they haven't yet reached the point where they have lost no competitiveness vis-a-vis Germany compared to the starting point. So there's still a little bit of a competitiveness gap there, but some of it's been reversed. Unfortunately, the reversal has taken place mainly on the wages side, not on the productivity side. So their unit labor costs are adjusting, not because productivity is going up, but because costs are coming down, because wages are being restrained. Now, we did research on the income convergence issue, and we look at two indicators of convergence, the so-called beta convergence. And beta convergence is simply looking at the coefficient, the beta, of a regression, regressing the country's starting point on the growth rate. And if there's a negative relationship, that means higher income countries initially have lower growth rates, so a negative slope, and lower income countries have higher growth. So if you see the line here, the blue line here, that's downward sloping, that shows convergence. If the line is not downward sloping, it's not showing convergence. And what we see here is for the initial countries that joined the Eurozone, that's the red line here, there has been very little convergence over the period from 1993 to 2015. What is interesting is if you were to take Ireland out of the regression, there's no convergence at all. Essentially, that line is being tilted over so slightly downward by that huge outlier, which is Ireland. And in fact, and I'll add this point as well, if you took Italy out of the regression, it would also show no convergence. Italy has been converging from the high-income side to the low-income side. So that's not the kind of convergence that we actually want to see, but that's reflected in the regression here. Now, the good news is that if you include the new countries that joined the euro after its initial formation, you do get very strong convergence. So there's good news here on the new, the so-called new member states. Latvia, Estonia, Slovakia, Slovenia, Malta, etc., they tilt the line very sharply downward. There has been a lot of convergence from those countries. So you could also sort of draw the conclusion that maybe it's not the euro per se that's driving this, maybe there's something else driving it. Although again here, we're going to see in a minute that when we look at the timeline of convergence, a lot of that convergence for these countries was also happening in the run-up to joining the euro rather than the period after belonging to the euro. So here is another indicator of convergence, which we call sigma convergence, which is essentially looking at the coefficient of variation among all the countries year by year. And this allows you to get a bit of a time series for what's been happening to that coefficient of variation or that degree of convergence over time. And here the time series shows us a very interesting phenomenon. It shows that in the run-up to in the formation of the euro area in this sort of 1960s and 1970s era, there was a lot of convergence. So countries were coming closer together in their income levels. Again, we're talking here about the initial 12 that joined. And then there's a period of sort of stagnation in convergence. And then we see another sort of wave of convergence in the run-up to the euro. And I think this is because countries were actively implementing policies to get ready for the currency, and you saw some convergence there as well. And then once we have the existence of the euro, we have essentially two phases. A sort of a stagnation phase of convergence where it wasn't getting better, but it wasn't getting worse. And then you have actually a divergence phase with the crisis. And this, of course, reflects the chart that I showed at the very beginning, where there's been a huge difference in performance since the crisis. Now, it is possible, in fact, probable, that some part of this divergence is cyclical in nature. And as the economies recover, you'll see some of that start to come back down. But I would also argue that at least some of this is structural in nature, and it's not going to be resolved just by the economic recovery. Now, here again, when we add the new member states into the picture, where we don't have the data going all the way back because many of these were communist countries with different types of statistical systems, you see very, very strong convergence. So the convergence comes out quite strongly. And this is the period when these countries were joining the euro. And then again, here again, you have a bit of a stagnation period and a slight divergence period in the crisis days. So this is a more detailed version of the convergence picture for those new member states. And here you can see, by and large, with the exception of Cyprus, there's been pretty good convergence. Every country shows some degree of improved income levels vis-a-vis the Eurozone average. Now, turning to the issue of nominal convergence, I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this, but I want to point out one very important fact. There was a lot of nominal convergence in the run-up to the euro. Not a surprise. It was a requirement to join the euro. Countries were actively pursuing policies to deliver that nominal convergence. And we can see that here with interest rates converging quite sharply. This is the real long-term bond yield, and you can see that convergence in the run-up to the euro as the countries were actively managing their monetary policies to bring interest rates and inflation down. However, and I say this in the title to this chart, the inflation converged and interest rates converged, but interest rates converged by more than inflation. And if interest rates converge by more than inflation, when you take interest, when you take bond yields, nominal bond yields, and you delete the, and you adjust them for inflation, what you get is real bond yields actually overshooting. And so we see a phenomenon. This is the, this chart shows the spread between the real bond yields in certain member states and Germany. So Germany is the zero line here. And what you can see in this chart is that for a period of time in the boom years, other countries had real interest rates that were lower than Germany's. And this was just a kind of a coincidental phenomenon of the fact that interest rates converged more than inflation rates converged, and that flipped the real interest rates in a differential fashion. But of course, now when you see realize that there was a huge boom in things like commercial credit, consumer credit, and real estate markets in some of those member states, you can see part of what's driving that. It's the real interest rate actually below Germany's that was driving that sort of financial market activity. Now, that reversed, of course, with the crisis when interest rates rose sharply as investors rediscovered the idea that there was riskier assets in different member states. So there was kind of this idea before that everybody was risk-free, and so the spreads between Germany and other countries were really very low. That reversed, but now we're starting to see the recovery there on the nominal interest rate side. Now, when we turn to this third aspect of convergence, which is business cycle convergence, we also have an interesting phenomenon here. So what we looked at in our research was two aspects of business cycle convergence. The first one is what's called here concordance. And the concept of concordance is essentially an answer to the question, what percentage of the time are we in the same phase of the economic cycle? Are we all in the upturn at the same time? Are we in the peak at the same time? Are we in the trough at the same time? Are we in the downturn at the same time? And what you can see here, this concordance indicator, if we were perfectly synchronized, it would be 1. So it's an index from 0 to 1. And what you see here is that the concordance of business cycles was pretty high when we started this process, even before the existence of the euro. But it has climbed quite nicely over the years. So on this indicator of business cycle convergence, there has, in fact, been convergence. And it's been pretty steady over that time period. But we then asked a second question, which is, okay, we're in the same phase of the cycle at the same time, by and large, 75% of the time, 0.7 or 0.75 indicator. But how big are those different cycles? And so we looked at the amplitude of the cycle, not just the phase of the cycle. And what we saw here is a different phenomenon. This is a differential in growth rates where 0 would mean the size of the cycle is the same in all countries. And the larger the negative number, the farther apart the amplitude of the cycle is. And what we find is that the amplitude of the cycle can be quite different. It improved in the initial years of the euro, but during the crisis it got worse. So what does this say in layman's terms? This says Spain and Germany are most of the time in the same part of the economic cycle, but the size of the cycle is much greater in Spain than it is in Germany. In Germany, it's a much milder up and down cycle. In Spain, it's a much more severe up and down cycle. So from a monetary policy standpoint, it's nice that we have concordance or a great degree of concordance, but there's still the challenge for the ECB of saying, well, we're in the same phase of the cycle, but the cycle's much deeper in Spain than it is in Germany, so how do we calibrate monetary policy for that? So again, concordance of the cycle, but amplitude divergence. We did the same research with financial cycles. So what we did here, there's an index, we took it out of the literature, we didn't invent a new one, which is used to measure financial cycles. And it's an index that takes into consideration credit growth and real estate prices and things like that. And what we did was we looked at that financial cycle and then we defined the financial cycle for each country and then we looked at the same indicators, concordance and amplitude. And here what we found was very interesting. In terms of concordance, every country in the Eurozone had higher concordance at the end than at the beginning, with one exception. But that exception is a very important one, Germany. Germany's concordance of its financial cycle with the other 11 countries declined over the period consistently. And so this is what you see in this chart here. So Germany's concordance was actually quite high for financial cycles. It became lower in the first period of the euro, and then it became even lower in the next phase of the euro. Whereas with other countries, it went down initially, but then it went up, and it went up to a level that was even higher than the beginning. So one of the interesting conclusions of the paper is that when you have the largest country that has a different kind of financial cycle than the others, that poses potentially a challenge. We also looked at the amplitude, and we found a similar phenomenon to the phenomenon for the business cycle, which is to say, while there's greater concordance among the 11, excepting Germany, the amplitudes have diverged, and amplitude differences have gotten worse. Here's an illustration of the point about financial cycles. So the red line is the German financial cycle, the blue line is the Spain financial cycle. And you can see very clearly the amplitude difference. The German cycles are very mild, the Spanish cycles are much more pronounced. You can also see, not statistically, but visually, the fact that the cycles seem a bit less synchronized than they used to be. You can see here that the upturns are a little bit out of sync. And here they start to get even more out of sync. And here they're definitely out of sync, where the German financial cycle is actually turning down while the Spain financial cycle is booming. So that's just a visual illustration of the data that I presented to you in the previous chart. So let me give you a summary of the overall convergence picture here with this sort of heat map. What we saw in terms of real convergence was a lot of convergence movement before the euro, not much convergence in the first decade of the euro, but not divergence either, and actual divergence during the economic crisis. On the nominal side, we saw real convergence before the euro. We continued to have relatively strong convergence in the euro's first decade for interest rates, a little bit less on inflation. That's where those inflation differentials started to cause differences in the real interest rate. And then divergence in the interest rates because of risk premia for countries in crisis, with little additional convergence on the inflation rate. When we look at the business cycles, we see a phenomenon of the synchronization becoming better, by and large, but the amplitudes actually diverging, getting farther apart. And we see a kind of a similar picture on the financial cycles. Some divergence on the synchronization, but then convergence, with the exception of Germany. And on the amplitudes, we see divergence. Even though we're in the same part of the financial cycle, the size of those financial cycles has actually diverged. So going from sort of this diagnostic section to the policy recommendations section, we started to think about what does all this mean for policymakers going forward. And the first thing we wanted to discuss was, what was it that the initial founders of the euro were expecting to happen that were going to generate convergence? If you go back to the Dolores Report or even back to the Treaty of Rome, you see that there is a strong belief that real convergence would be a result of European Union and European Monetary Union. How was that supposed to happen? How were these different kinds of convergence supposed to take place? Well, the first one was there was an expectation that the formation of monetary union would increase trade in goods and services. That with a single currency, you wouldn't have the same transactions costs, and the lower transaction costs would foster higher trade. And higher trade would synchronize the economies greater, because even if you didn't have high demand in your country, if Germany next door had high demand, you would export more to them, and you would be closer to being synchronized in the cycle. In fact, trade did increase among Eurozone countries. But interestingly, for that set of countries, trade with the rest of the world grew actually faster. So there wasn't a differential increase in trade within the Eurozone that could drive some kind of a convergence dynamic. There was also the expectation that labor mobility would grow, that it would be easier to go across for Spanish workers to work in Germany, for Greek workers to work in France, and that additional labor mobility would also help convergence, because when a worker goes from a poor country to a rich country, it actually helps convergence on both sides. It keeps wage costs down in the richer country, it raises the income of the person who's moved, and often that person sends money back to his home country to family members and increases the income back home. And even if he doesn't send money back, it reduces the labor supply in that country and keeps an upward pressure on wages. So for all those reasons, there could be some convergence dynamics from labor mobility. But in fact, labor mobility, it has increased, but it's still quite low. If you do a comparison of intrastate mobility in the U.S. versus international mobility in Europe, you find there is much lower mobility for Europeans than for Americans. That's not surprising because it's not quite the same. It's not an apples to apples comparison if you're talking about moving from one state in the United States to another. But it does give you an illustration that labor mobility hasn't been a driving force in convergence. There was also an expectation that maybe capital flows would engender greater convergence. So the logic here would be richer countries that had higher productivity levels would invest in the poorer countries and help bring their productivity levels up through that investment, and that would help bring convergence to the Eurozone. What we found, in fact, is that there was a lot of investment from the richer countries to the less rich countries within the Eurozone. But a very interesting thing happened. The foreign direct investment of Germany didn't end up going to the south. It went east. It went to the new member states, by and large. And that was something I don't think that was anticipated when people were conceiving of the euro. And so there's huge, as a percent of GDP, huge foreign direct German investment in places like Hungary, the Czech Republic, Slovakia, etc. And there was a lot of investment going to the southern countries, to Spain, Greece, Portugal. It tended to be portfolio investment and bank investment. So it was money, what we would sometimes call hot money, but it was also money that ended up fueling real estate bubbles and consumer credit booms. So foreign direct investment was going east, and hot money investment was going south, and rather than fostering convergence, that money flow was perhaps inhibiting convergence by inducing a big financial cycle boom, which then reversed. Finally, on the structural adjustment side, there's a very clear expectation in the founding documents of the euro, if you look back to the Delors report, that countries would immediately realize that under a common currency, they could no longer use exchange rate devaluation to maintain competitiveness. So they would voluntarily, on their own, implement structural reforms to improve the flexibility of their economies and the productivity of their economies, and that would allow them to adjust, and that would help generate converging growth. In fact, that also did not really happen until the pressure of the crisis hit on the countries. There wasn't a huge movement of converging structural reforms. We do some research. We mentioned this in the paper. I don't have the slide on this. But we look at the OECD indicators of structural reform and look at a difference between sort of high productivity and low productivity. You don't really see much difference. There was some structural reform everywhere, but not more structural reforms in the countries that might need it for the convergence purposes. Finally, there was an expectation that by leaving fiscal policy in the national realm, countries could use their fiscal policy under the fiscal rules of the union to have low deficits or even surpluses in good times and have countercyclical fiscal policy which would help cushion the downturns in bad times. And if you've cushioned the upturns and the downturns, you're going to be closer to the median, and if you're closer to the median, you've got greater cyclical convergence. In fact, that didn't happen. It's an empirical fact that fiscal policy in Europe over the last decade or so has largely been pro-cyclical rather than counter-cyclical. Some people would blame the fiscal rules and the way they're structured. Others would blame the national governments themselves for those choices that they made. But in reality, there was a pro-cyclical rather than a counter-cyclical fiscal policy, which would actually exacerbate the amplitude differences in cyclical convergence. So if you take that diagnosis, you can kind of derive from them some possible policy recommendations for the future. And the European authorities have been doing that. They have made some steps forward, very important steps forward, to help make the structure of the European architecture more robust against future cyclical shocks, but also to help foster a greater degree of converging growth in the future. The banking union is a huge step in that direction, particularly dealing with business cycles and financial cycles. There's a macroeconomic imbalances procedure, the so-called two-pack and six-pack and European semester, which all are ways in which the union as a whole reviews the economic policies of the individual countries and makes recommendations for changes. And finally, the existence of a European stability mechanism, which can pump money into countries in severe downturn cases in return for policy reforms that can help drive the cyclical and even the structural convergence process. So some of the issues that can, some of the policy actions that can still be taken, we've summarized them according to different types of convergence. And the business cycle convergence, clearly better use of countercyclical fiscal mechanisms would help. That could be using common fiscal backstops for Europe as a whole, which is a proposal that's actively under discussion, or using more simplified fiscal rules that can help countries deliver a more countercyclical national fiscal policy. Obviously, flexibility and enhancing structural reforms make a country able to resist shocks more easily, so those could also contribute. On the side of financial cycle convergence, a key policy would be greater use of macroprudential policies. So when we had these huge real estate and consumer credit booms in some countries, active macroprudential policies can help dampen down that cycle. And if the upturn is less severe, the downturn will also be less severe. Now, to be fair, the Spaniards did use macroprudential policy to a certain degree before the last crisis. They knew what was happening, and they were trying to counteract it. But we need to have even more aggressive use of macroprudential policies in the future. To help the financial cycle be more synchronized and better adjusted in terms of amplitude, a completion of the banking union is absolutely critical. If you don't have a common backstop to the banking union, that is to say European deposit insurance and a fiscal backstop for the resolution fund, ultimately banking problems will end up exacerbating the linkage between countries and their financial sectors, which will put them out of whack with each other. Completing the capital markets union would also help. If we have better and more flexible capital flows among countries, that can also help dampen crises. Research for the United States has shown that one of the biggest stabilizing factors among U.S. states is financial flows, which can come in and out of states that are doing well or poorly quite quickly. So it's not just a fiscal kind of a backstop, but a financial sector, private financial sector backstop as well. Finally, on real convergence, as I started the discussion, ultimately it's about boosting productivity growth in low productivity growth countries. You can't get sustainable income convergence unless you've got productivity growth to back it up. So growth-enhancing structural reforms can help. Investment policies that invest in research and development, education policies to improve the productivity of workers, all of these can contribute. And growth-friendly fiscal policy. And by growth-friendly fiscal policy, I do not mean deficit spending per se. I mean looking at the composition of your spending and trying to make sure that you're spending in areas that generate productivity in the future. Infrastructure investment, education investment, R&D investment can generate greater economic growth in the future, with the public sector playing an important role there. We did an exercise in our European team at the IMF where we did some exercise of what if countries did simultaneously a set of comprehensive structural reforms to improve productivity growth. And what we see here, and this is it's just a simulation, so don't take the specific numbers too seriously, but the simulation shows that the low initial productivity growth countries and the high initial productivity growth countries both get a growth boom if all together implement productivity-enhancing reforms. Not surprisingly, the low productivity countries get a bigger boom because they've got more room to improve productivity if they all work together on implementing reforms. So this is one of the potential ways of dealing with this real income productivity, or real income lack of convergence problem. On the political economy side, I think that it's important to say that pure economic theory does not in any way suggest that different real income levels cannot persist over time in a monetary union. There are persistent income differences among states in the United States. There are countries that unilaterally adopt another country's currency and they don't converge in real income terms. Ecuador uses the US dollar. Montenegro unilaterally adopted the euro. That doesn't necessarily mean that Montenegro is or has to converge to the income level of the European Union. However, from a political standpoint, there is a challenge to the viability of the European project if there's a lack of income convergence. So there's a political aspect to this and not just a purely economic aspect to this. So I'll conclude my remarks there by saying Convergence is a complex issue. It's a lot more complex than I thought when I started doing this research, because it has these different dimensions. The picture for Europe is not universally bad. It's not universally good. There are clearly, however, some challenges out there, particularly in the real income convergence side and the political implications that that has. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much for this very interesting talk. I should mention that there's obviously a policy paper which you can download on the IMF website. Perhaps let us start with questions from your side. Perhaps everybody should quickly introduce themselves and take 2 to 3 questions, and then Mr. Franks may respond. So, do we have some more junior members of the audience? You know, in the beginning, it's always like that. Nobody wants to talk, and then in the end, there's no time for questions, and you are disappointed, so go for it.
Mike, go ahead.
Okay, then.
No one else volunteers.
Okay, thanks. 3 questions. Lorenzo Codogno, by the way, visiting professor here at the LSE. The first question is, have you tried to do the same exercise for the states in the United States? And if yes, what kind of results have you found? Because you would expect that, given there is much more mobility of factors, you would expect a different outcome. But it's not granted, so to speak. Second question is: it looks like a kind of catch-22, because you kind of implicitly assume that you need to have convergence in order to achieve greater integration. But at the same time, actually, convergence could be a result of greater integration. So how do you kind of, take into account that? Finally, a little bit of a provocative question. In the States, nobody cares about, low productivity in Florida, because, if you specialize in golf courses, that you achieve low productivity, okay, and much lower than manufacturing. So if you are in a kind of integrated common economic area, single state, who cares about major differences in productivity if they reflect the specialization or in the allocation of resources?
That's actually already 3 questions, right?
We can take maybe one more person if anybody wants to volunteer. I haven't seen a lot of hands up there, but there's somebody in the back.
Yeah, okay, perfect.
Hi, I'm a student in political economy of Europe, and I'd just like to ask, can you clarify the difference between the central bank OMT program and the European Stability Mechanism?
The ESM and the ONT?
Yeah.
Okay.
Somebody else? No? Okay, then perhaps...
Okay. So let me take these questions in order here. We actually have a little box in the paper about U.S. states. And there has been some research. Javier Saleh-Martin and others have done some work on this back into the 1990s, looking at the convergence among U.S. states. And the answer is that there has been convergence among U.S. states. It has been a very, very long process, and it has been a slow process. So it shouldn't be particularly surprising that the convergence among U.S. states is higher than the convergence among countries in the Eurozone, because there's just a longer history of time for that convergence to happen. And so yes, that has happened. It is more convergent. But there are some reasons to think that, it might improve for Europe as well from that standpoint. You absolutely are right to point out to the factors there as well. I mean, obviously, labor mobility is much easier between U.S. states than it is among countries. You don't have a language barrier. You don't have the same kind of differences in labor legislation and in social security systems. One of the proposals to help labor mobility, for example, is pension portability, which is much more difficult if you've got a national-based pension system in the European countries versus the U.S., where the social security system is the same in different states. So those types of things might be factors there in the convergence. On the second question about convergence and greater integration, I think you're absolutely right. There can be a circular relationship here. Greater convergence can drive greater integration can drive greater convergence. But I think the concern is the opposite can also happen. If you have less convergence or divergence, which is what we have seen in recent years, that could actually drive less integration and a move for lack of integration and devolving responsibilities back to the member states. Now, we can argue about whether that's a good thing economically, but I think politically that's a big concern of the people who are driving the European process, that you're in fact going to start a process of disintegration, literally disintegrating perhaps of the EU as a result of this kind of divergence. So I think it does go both ways, absolutely. On the question about who cares about productivity, I mean, I think obviously we can have productivity differentials in different industries. We can have productivity differentials among different countries. But if at the same time the time series trend is showing a decline rather than an improvement, I think that's where there's a real problem. Obviously, if some countries are more specialized in services sector and they lower productivity services, that might be, there might be a justification for that. But if it's also declining over time, that's a concern as well. And if you don't have the equalizing mechanisms, right? I mean, if Florida was producing golfing experiences with wages of Bangladesh, that would be a huge problem in the United States. But of course, there are mechanisms of labor mobility, there are legal mechanisms that make sure that that doesn't happen, so that an unskilled worker on the golf course in Florida doesn't earn that much different than an unskilled worker in Silicon Valley, who probably earns more, but not that much more when you deflate by the cost of living. So I think that ultimately productivity is about your ability to provide goods and services to your population. So if you don't have productivity growth, you don't have the ability to provide goods and services at an improving standard of living to your population. Now, there is an argument out there, sort of an ecological-based argument, saying, well, maybe we as a society need to step away from the idea that living standards have to continuously increase for forever, because there are externalities like damage to the environment that may cause problems there. I recognize that fact. That's a bit of a different argument than what we're discussing here, but I would say if your goal is to produce improved living standards for your populations and converging living standards for your populations, ultimately it has to be about productivity growth. You can throw more labor and more capital at things and generate more growth, but we have a demographic problem in Europe, and capital spending is not going to be able to recover or compensate for the fact that you need that productivity growth over time. On the question from the back of the room about OMT versus ESM, yeah, so the OMT was a permission that was given to the European Central Bank to outright purchase assets if it so chose to do, if it chose to do so. The European Central Bank has not chosen to do so, but it has the legal ability to do so if it needed to for its monetary policy purposes. The ESM is a separate institution that was set up by intergovernmental agreement among the Eurozone member states to create a stabilization fund to help countries that got into economic difficulties. The ESM is essentially running a parallel operation to what the IMF does when it uses its resources to help states that get into economic difficulties. It has a pot of money. It can lend that pot of money out to countries that are in trouble in return for those countries undertaking a series of economic reforms. And that's what we do, that's what the ESM does, and that's what we have done together with the ESM in a series of European countries, in Greece, in Cyprus, in Ireland, in Portugal. We have worked together with the ESM where they have dispersed European money, we have dispersed international money to help those countries. So it's kind of a stabilization and reform mechanism that is a separate institution from the other European institutions.
Again, perhaps all in the back, I think you were first, and then Diederik, and then Kevin, perhaps.
Thank you. My name is Leon. I'm also studying political economy of Europe, and I wanted to ask, whenever you found non-convergence or divergence, do you think it was an issue between two groups of countries, say north and south of Europe, or a more way more complex dynamics than that?
Great question.
Diederik, I think, was with that.
Well, my name is Diederik, and I'm also a student of political economy here. I was wondering, you mentioned in your talk that there's a need in Europe for structural flexibility, not so much structural convergence. Speaking on this, the Dutch Prime Minister in Davos actually said that in the Netherlands and other northern countries, there's this enormous structural flexibility right now, the capacity to loan more. So in your mind, should the like the number one priority for the Southern Bloc be increasing debt sustainability, or are there other factors that need to be tended to first?
Kevin? And can I encourage the female share of the audience to also speak up? Otherwise, it's a bit biased, no? So become active.
Kevin Featherstone, head of the European Institute. You've touched on the case already of the bailout states, which brought the IMF very much in direct ownership of a structural reform agenda in Europe. Of course, in that context, the IMF has been criticized for its time horizons and for the prioritization. And we've had something of a competition between the EU Commission and the IMF in terms of who was responsible for particular conditions set in the Greek case, for example, some of them being very controversial. In terms of prioritization of conditions and the time horizons for structural reform, what are the lessons do you think the IMF can draw from the bailout cases? I've read the IMF's own evaluation report of these cases. But in the bigger picture, did the IMF get it right? What would you do differently next time?
Yeah, great question. Take those three, or you want?
Yeah, I think okay. That's.
So on the first question about non-convergence, is it groups of countries or is it something more complicated? That is an excellent question. We've decided, the researchers that did this paper have decided that we need to dig deeper into exactly this question. And we've started a research project where we're going to dig into regional convergence in regions of countries. And then one of the elements of this new paper is going to be to try to decompose the national convergence into how much of it is coming from the nation and how much is it coming from the individual regions. So the question is Italy not converging with Germany, or is it certain regions in Italy that are not converging with certain regions in Germany, and that's what's driving the results? So you could theoretically, you could say, well, Milan is converging perfectly nicely with Munich. The problem is that that Sicily is not converging with East Germany, or you know, that's exactly the question that we're going to look at next. And we're building a data set right now with more than 100 regions across Europe, and we're going to run the same analysis to try to dig into why that's the case. And we also have some information about, say, governance structures, spending in different regions, in different municipalities, and investment in those different areas, credit in the different areas. We're going to try to dig into that. So watch this space, and maybe next year this time I can come back and present that paper. Hopefully it's sooner than 12 months, but in about 8 or 9 months we're hoping to have the results of that paper as well. So excellent question. Exactly the question I'm asking myself. On the question of structural flexibility and debt sustainability, I mean, I guess my view would be, yes, we need structural flexibility and we need debt sustainability, but no, those are not the same thing. So I think maybe I don't know the quote that you were referring to, but some countries that have relatively low debt to GDP ratios say, look, having a low debt to GDP ratio allows us the flexibility of using fiscal policy more aggressively when times are bad. And that is absolutely true. And we are very much of the view in the IMF that now that things in Europe are finally turning around and growth rates are positive throughout the Union, this is the time for countries to rebuild those fiscal buffers. But you've got to rebuild the fiscal buffers by running a prudent fiscal policy. This is not the time to use all the margin of that you can under the fiscal rules and not consolidate when times are good. Otherwise, the next time we have a downturn and countries are already highly indebted, they won't have the same ability to borrow to cushion the blow, because they'll be credit constrained when times are bad. So that debt sustainability argument is an absolutely legitimate argument, and I totally buy into it. But I would say that that's not the same thing as structural flexibility. When we talk about structural flexibility, what we're talking about is if there is a negative shock to the economy, how quickly can labor markets adjust? How quickly can different sectors of the economy can adjust? How easy is it to move resources from declining industries into booming industries to readjust in a flexible way. Now, to give the very simple illustration of this, when you have a flexible exchange rate and you have a negative shock that reduces your competitiveness with the rest of the world, one answer would be you just devalue your currency. And that allows you to regain that lost competitiveness. If you don't have the tool of your own currency that you can devalue, then you actually have to use the real economy to absorb that shock. And that means your labor market has to be flexible. Wages may need to be more flexible. You need to have more flexibility in where credit goes and how it goes, how easy it is for industries to close businesses and to open in new areas. So it's this sort of creative destruction kind of an issue on the firm side and flexibility on the labor market side. And what we've done some research on this, not me, but other people in the IMF, looking at these areas of structural flexibility. And we find there's a lot of room for improvement in the services sector in Europe. There are a lot of heavy restrictions, particularly in professional services in European countries. There is not a common market of professional services. And in some countries, they're extremely rigid, and it's very hard to move resources from one services sector to another services sector. So that's one area in particular. Also, things like retail restrictions in some countries, your ability to sell and locate businesses and change businesses and your opening hours of businesses, those are much more highly regulated in some countries than others. And that element of flexibility could be used to cushion adjustment. So that's kind of what we're talking about when we're talking about structural flexibility. Now, this excellent question about IMF programs in Europe and the lessons learned. I actually have an entire presentation on this question. I could also come back and give that again. I actually did it at SOAS a few months ago. But let me dispel one common misperception and then talk about some lessons. The common misperception is that the intervention in program countries in Europe has been by and large a failure. And that is actually not consistent with what the data actually show. The IMF had programs in almost a dozen countries in Europe. And I would say, with the exception of the problems that are still ongoing in Greece, they have by and large been a success. Iceland was the very first program in this last crisis. Not an EU country, but it is the first country that we lent money to. We had programs in Latvia, in Romania, in Hungary, in Serbia. And then, of course, there were the programs in the Euro member states, which included Cyprus, Portugal, Ireland, Greece, and I'm missing one. There are five of them. Spain was just an ESM program. It wasn't the IMF at all. Anyway, the point is, if you look at those programs overall, actually the Cyprus program was a roaring success. The Irish program was a roaring success. There was adjustment. It was painful, but it was less painful than it would otherwise have been because there was a massive inflow of international money to support. The economy recovered very quickly. Growth is positive. We've surpassed the pre-crisis GDP levels. Same is the story in Portugal. Same is the story in Cyprus. So this idea that these were a failure, I think, is too much focusing on the difficulties in the Greek case. There have been problems in all of them, and there have been lessons learned in all of them. I personally was in charge of the Romania program, and I learned a lot of lessons in the course of the 3.5 years that I worked on the Romania program. Let me highlight some of the lessons that I think we learned. The first lesson that we learned is, and we in the IMF frankly learned this coming out of the Asian crisis in the late 1990s, that you have to be a lot more flexible on fiscal adjustment if the economic situation becomes worse. So I'll give you the example that I worked on. In Romania, we worked together with the European Commission and we designed a program that was based on -4% growth in 2009. We implemented the program, we issued the first disbursement, we came back 3 months later for the first quarterly review, and we realized growth wasn't going to be -4, it was going to be -8. You can't have the same fiscal targets if you have -8 growth as if you had -4. You've got to adjust the target. You've got to be more flexible in the program. And we were able to bring that flexibility. In previous crises, I'm not sure I, as the mission chief, would have had that authority. But the IMF was able to become more flexible in adjusting the targets for the changing circumstances. So that was one lesson that we learned. A second lesson that we learned, and this was in the Independent Evaluation Office report that came out on the Greek program, was that in an economic crisis period, fiscal multipliers tend to be larger than in normal times. And so the negative effect of fiscal consolidation is larger than we had anticipated. And we miscalculated that in Greece, and therefore the program ended up being more contractionary initially than we had anticipated. I think we've learned that lesson, and we were applying that lesson in the later Greek programs, including this one that's currently underway. I think we've also learned, and we've done some research about structural reforms and when is it good to do structural reforms. The research and the reality are a bit still not completely in harmony, because what the research shows is that structural reforms give you the best results when you do them in good times. They give you the best economic results faster when you do them in good times. Why? Because when you do them in bad times, some of those structural reforms have a temporary negative effect on economic activity. And if they have a temporary negative effect on economic activity and economic activity is already bad, then they can exacerbate the downturn. But unfortunately, often it's only when times are bad that countries have the real political will to do that. So you end up doing them sometimes in bad times, even though theoretically it would be better if we could do those in good times. And that is why the message, if you listen to IMF statements, you'll hear Christine Lagarde going around the world saying, the time to repair the roof is when the sun is shining. She's used that quote all over the place, including in Davos most recently. And that's the message we're trying to send now, is this is the best time to do the reforms. We acknowledge that you're not always under the same pressure to do the reforms, but this is the best time. Another related issue that our research has shown is that product market reforms have less negative impact in the short run than labor market reforms. So if you're worried about that negative effect in the downturn, sometimes combining the two together or focusing first on product market reforms and then on labor market reforms might actually help. Labor market reforms do sometimes have the impact of lowering temporarily wages in some sectors or lowering employment in some sectors. So in a downturn, that can be particularly difficult to absorb. But if you do that at the same time as doing product market reforms that can actually generate more economic activity, you might be able to cushion that blow. So those are some of the lessons. We have a lot of others, but those are just a few that I would like to point out.
Okay. Yeah, thank you. You, and then perhaps you, and then there was another question all in the back. Okay, thank you. Antigone, can you perhaps? Thank you.
Good afternoon. Laia Kumerma from the Master in International Relations. I had two questions. They are kind of related, one to the other. The first is that you talked about the necessity for a banking union or a complete banking union. I wanted to ask, in relation to Brexit, is it seen as an opportunity to integrate further, or is it more a threat because we're going to lose London as the fiscal center of Europe? And then what could amend that? What other potential candidates could take London's place in Europe? And the second one is, like, when we implement those programs, they always have social repercussions. Are those contemplated into the formula? Because, for example, there's also issues of political uncertainty, such as the Brexit, or we were looking at Spanish indicators, but do they contemplate, for example, the impact that the Catalan crisis could have for the future, and how is this put it into the formula? Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you.
Hello, Lucas Titz from City University. I'm studying political economy. And my question is, the German Bundesbank recently announced that they will include the Chinese renminbi in their foreign exchange reserves. And in general, there's rumor about a change in the international monetary system. My question is, how do you see this change, and what is the role of the euro in this future monetary system, and other implications for the euro divergence?
Okay.
Hi, Angelo Martelli, European Institute. Three very quick points. On the labor mobility, I beg to differ slightly on the EU versus US comparison. I think also research from your own department by Prakash Lungani and Furcherev actually showed that the two systems have actually been aligned in the last few years. And also ample evidence from, you know, Southern European countries, brain drain towards France, Germany, and the UK seems to support this. On the measure of productivity, it seems a bit of the productivity puzzle of the last years. Also, Italy still being a top sixth manufacturer in the world in the past 10 years. And this is according to also another IMF studies by Andrew Trifin. It seems that this is also due to the how we measure productivity in terms of cost-based versus price-based competitiveness. I don't know if you have done some exercises along that line. And the third is, so I don't know if it's my wrong interpretation, but I could, in your talk, you were saying something about capital flows have to start flowing again from certain countries. Is this, in a way, a shift in policy towards recommending also Germany to start investing a lot more? Because you talked about FDI towards Eastern European countries, but is this also related to some sort of, you know, the investment plan by Juncker should be a lot stronger, or is it my wrong interpretation?
Okay. Should we take those? Okay, so the first one on banking union and Brexit, that's a very interesting question. What I will say on that point is that people I talk to in Brussels definitely see Brexit as an opportunity to capture some of that market, right? You know, my own personal view on this is the City of London will always be a huge financial center, regardless of, you know, Brexit and the conditions that Brexit takes place. But on the margin, clearly other European countries are hoping to capture some of that business. And they're actually hoping that an upside of what they consider to be overall a negative thing of Brexit could be that they could have more economic activity in the banking sector in different member states. I think there is also a sense that there is a need for Europe to push some of the capital market union components about regulating the non-banking aspects of the financial sector activity that might move to make sure that those things are properly regulated when they move here. I had one European tell me last week, what we have done in Europe is essentially outsource regulation of these financial activities to the British, who have done it in London. And now we won't be able to outsource that to London anymore. We'll have to regulate it ourselves. And so there's a lot of thinking going on in Europe about if they bring some of those activities to the continent or force it legally to come to the continent, they need to be prepared to properly regulate that in the future. So that is certainly, London will always be a major financial center, no doubt about it. But on the margin, the Europeans see this as an opportunity to try to deepen their own financial market activities. On the social repercussions of the question, you make an excellent point. This is an area where the IMF's position has evolved very substantially over the 25 years that I've worked there. The IMF did 25 years ago would basically, if you asked a social question, the answer would have been, not our job. That's somebody else's job. The World Bank's job, the, you know, OECD, they look at the social things, not our job. And I think the realization over the last couple of decades has been that although we are a macroeconomic stabilization institution, we cannot ignore the social impact of that stabilization. And although we previously would think that it's the country's job to cushion the blow, we just define with them what adjustment needs to be done, and then they take care of it, we now actually include social protections in the conditionality of our IMF programs. There was a study from our independent evaluation office that indicated over the last few years, more than 80% of IMF programs have explicitly social protection measures as conditions that the countries need to act on as part of the IMF program. So that's evolving. Now we can argue about whether it's enough or whether we're being sensitive enough, but we've gone from a position where that wasn't a focus to an area where we're actually including it in our conditionality and trying to take that more into consideration. On your point about the Catalan crisis, I know our Spanish team has done some simulations on this point, but actually, if you look at the new economic forecast, the World Economic Forecast that the IMF just issued at Davos, last week, you'll see there's a very slight downward revision for Spain. Now, there was an upward revision in almost every other country in Europe. So you might say, well, it's partly downward for Spain, but it's partly also you didn't get the upward boost that you might have gotten if you didn't have this problem. But of course, it's still very speculative what will actually happen. And so, you know, as economists, you kind of have to take a scenario and say, well, let's assume there's X disruption and we just put that into our forecast without knowing what the political ramifications would ultimately be. Then there was a question about the Bundesbank's inclusion of the renminbi and what that means. You may be aware that the IMF included the renminbi in our own currency, which is the SDR. And so we've already gone in that direction. And we actually went through a process with the Chinese where we were pushing them for greater convertibility of their currency, greater opening of their markets, their financial markets, before we did that. I think that this is partially a recognition of fact, that China is an increasingly important part of the world economy, and their currency is also increasingly a part of international transactions, and that's why it's being included by national central banks and by the IMF itself. So that's partly a recognition of reality. But I would say it's also a reflection of the fact that we all want China to be a full participant in the international financial system. And, you know, arbitrarily trying to sort of exclude them for this or that reason is actually counterproductive. So I see it both as kind of a political economic measure saying, look, we're in the international financial system. China's in the international financial system. We want them to be a full participant and feel like they have a full voice. That's why we also have increased the quota of China in the IMF quite substantially. And in our next quota review, it'll go up much more again to reflect the greater size of China in the world economy. But it's also the reason for, I think, a reason for the inclusion of the renminbi. If I could just make an additional comment there, the interesting question for me right now is not the inclusion of the renminbi, it's what's happening with the development of cryptocurrencies and what that will mean for the monetary system in the future. I don't know the answer to that, but that's an issue that I'm thinking about a lot now. If we ever saw a central bank put Bitcoin in its reserves, that would be quite something to see, and that would be a huge shakeup of the system. China is just another player in the world system, and they become a more important player, so it makes absolute sense to bring them in to the reserves picture. But cryptocurrencies are a different animal altogether, and that's something, that's a real challenge to think about for the future. Let's see, we had a question about the issue about labor flows. You're absolutely right. I mean, whether the labor flows in the US and Europe are comparable or not depends in part on whether you're looking at stocks or flows. In stocks, which we did, we report that in the paper, the stock of people in the US who are working in a state other than the one that they were born is enormously high. It's close to 50%, I think it's 30-something, high 30s or 40%. The percentage of Europeans who are born in a different European country who are working in another European country is quite low. But on the margin, you are correct. The flows don't look as much different as the stocks do. So that's a very fair point. And so I'll take that on board. On the productivity paradox and the issue of Italy, there is absolutely, those of you who follow these debates in economics know absolutely there is a real question. There's a worldwide decline in reported productivity, and there's an active debate as to whether that decline in productivity is a measurement factor, or if it's a real decline in productivity, or if it's a lag that, you know, so let me just briefly go over those three arguments. One is we are increasingly producing things that are much harder, whose productivity is much harder to measure than what we were producing in the past. What's the productivity of an improvement in the functioning of Facebook? How do you measure that? Those things are quite difficult to measure, and as all services are, but these sort of intellectual property-related services are even more difficult to measure the productivity. So that might be part of the explanation. Another part of the explanation is this sort of lag from innovation waves. We've seen this in the past, that there's a huge wave of innovation, say the development of computers or the development of railroads, whatever it is, and you see that there's a lag between the time that invention begins to be used and the time it shows up in generating productivity growth. And one of the explanations for why that might be is that it just takes people a while to figure out how to use these tools to be really productive. And so one of the arguments that is that productivity growth is low now, even though innovation is very high in some of these areas, like in social media and in sort of the sharing economy, et cetera. But we will see the productivity numbers come through later. So the one is we're not measuring it right. The other is we're measuring it okay, but it'll show up later in our statistics. Those could both possibly be the case. The people who look at this, and I'm not an expert at this, seem to suggest that yes, there's part of that. Yes, there's part of the other. But there is still, if you strip those two factors out, there's still a decline in productivity growth that we need to think about as an economy. I would add one other factor there, which you didn't mention, but there's also an argument that often new productivity comes embodied in new plant and equipment. And so if you have an investment drop like you do in a big recession, then you actually get less productivity growth because capital comes, it's not just the capital factor that happens when you buy a new machine, you also get new productivity growth in there. So you're getting both, and once investment recovers, you may see a recovery in productivity as well. And remember, Europe is, the Euro area is still not back to its pre-crisis investment level, so that could be a factor as well. So there's a lot of stuff going on in the productivity side. And that could apply to Italy as well. I mean, could it be, in fact, that Italian firms are more productive than we're measuring? Sure, that's possible. I think, you know, I go to Italy quite a lot, and the sort of differential in economic satisfaction compared to Germany suggests that the Italians don't think that's the reason. They think there's a real problem there. So, you know, but I'm not an expert on Italy, so I couldn't say more than that. Finally, there was the point about Germany investing more. So obviously, if you're running a huge current account surplus like Germany is, the counterpart of that in your national accounts has to be a huge deficit in the financial account, which means huge outward investment. That's arithmetically, it has to be true. It's an identity. So indeed, Germany is pumping out a lot of money to the rest of the world as the counterpart of its current account surplus. And absolutely, we are recommending, the IMF is recommending in our reports to Germany, in our meetings with the German government, that Germany should be investing more at home. Not because investing in the rest of the world is a bad thing, but we think the current account surplus could be moderated by doing some very productive and necessary infrastructure investment at home. So we feel like Germany has got fiscal space to invest more. They've got areas of investment that could generate real economic gains, and so they should do that. And that would have the side effect of reducing the current account surplus, which would be good for the rest of the world as well. So for all those reasons, I think we're definitely pushing greater investment in Europe, in Germany. That investment could come in things like investments in improving the autobahns and bridges. It can come in investments in education that could improve productivity over time. I have to say, as a non-European living in Europe, I was very disappointed with my early experiences on the autobahn. I was expecting the ability to drive at these incredible speeds and found myself stuck in enormous traffic jams for huge stretches as I tried to drive from Belgium to the south of Europe for my summer holidays. And I think partly that reflects the fact that maybe there's needs for some additional investment in that infrastructure there. So, yeah.
Okay. Perhaps one last round of questions. Yeah.
Oh, there. Yes,
you in the middle.
As usual, now we're overloaded with questions.
Yeah, it's like always the same. And then perhaps you, and then you. I think you were the first. Okay, if it's a very short question, then we take you on board as well. But please keep it short now. Okay, thank you.
I have a short question on risk absorption in the Eurozone.
Can you speak up a little bit? Sorry.
I have a quick question on risk absorption in the Eurozone. I was wondering, since equity is fully loss absorbing, whilst debt only absorbs when creditors default, how could we encourage equity markets to grow and to integrate, as opposed to credit markets, which usually break down during crisis?
That's a great question, yeah.
Yeah, and then you,
Thank you. It's Masato Kimura, Japanese journalist. If I may, I would like to make a follow-up question to your statement on cryptocurrency. Because in Japan, recently, 20 billion yen cryptocurrency was saved by hackers. And so now many Japanese doubt the future of cryptocurrency. And also in South Korea, the cryptocurrency agency was hacked by some countries. And also Chinese authority prohibited to mining and of cryptocurrency. And even though, why do you think cryptocurrency is a big challenge to financial service?
Yeah. Now you had a question, right? And then the last one in the back. So he.
From an IMF point of view, is there still an option for Grexit? And if so, would that be a potential economical match with Brexit? Or?
Hi, LSE alumni member. One of the things that you haven't mentioned particularly is the external investment into the Eurozone area, possibly by Russia, possibly by the United States. Do you take this into consideration in producing your data that you have produced today?
Great questions. So on the risk absorption question, it's a very important point that you make here. So I did mention in passing that some research on regional convergence in the U.S. shows that shock absorption in the U.S. happens more through financial markets than through fiscal policy. And this is essentially the point that you're making about risk absorption. So in other words, when a company fails, the equity holders fail. And if those equity holders are in different states, then that's cushioning the blow across the different states. Likewise, in Europe, if there was a company that failed and the equity loss was spread across countries, that cushions the blow. Or likewise on the boom side, when the equity is gaining a lot. Now, it's a well-known fact that Europe gets two-thirds of its investment financing from the banking system and only one-third from the capital markets. In the U.S., it's the reverse. It's two-thirds from the capital market and one-third from the banking system. So in that sense, your point is a very valid one, which is to say that if we have more equity investment, then we have an automatic risk absorption mechanism if that equity is held across cross-national borders. So I totally agree with your point there. And certainly one of the reasons for our support for Capital Markets Union is because we want to see some movement in that balance between equity and debt financing and between bank financing and capital market financing. Because again, with capital market financing, if the bondholders lose their investment because the bond is defaulted on, that shares the risk across all the bondholders in all the countries. Whereas if it defaults on a loan to the bank and the bank is in the country of the company, that whole loss is absorbed in that country. And if the bank itself fails as a result, that up until now has been the responsibility of the individual member state. Now with banking union, we can also spread that risk out across the countries as well, with common deposit insurance and a fiscal backstop for the single resolution fund. So for all those reasons, I very much agree with your observation there. On the question about cryptocurrencies, I have to say I'm not an expert, and I don't think we in the IMF have an official position on this, but I do know that Madame Lagarde has recently commented, and I think quite rightly, that this is an area where we need to pay increasing attention, because these can be macroeconomically significant. And as you mentioned with the issue of hacking or mining to produce additional coins or to subvert a cryptocurrency, there's a real challenge there, because this is a currency that is not controlled by a central bank, any central bank. And that means something for the management of macroeconomic policy if the size of these cryptocurrencies becomes macroeconomically significant. I think that's a real challenge that we policymakers in economics, the IMF and the central banks, need to take increasingly attention to. I'll just make one final observation about that, and that I think we need to distinguish between the cryptocurrencies and the blockchain technology. The blockchain technology has tremendously positive possibilities for managing transactions
in different areas of our economy. Cryptocurrencies are just one particular application of that blockchain technology, and they're an application in an area that is quite sensitive because it has to do with monetary policy. So, you know, you could be pro blockchain technology but anti cryptocurrency. It's an intellectually consistent position. Not that I'm taking a position on that, but I think it's a real challenge for policymakers to think about. It'll be too late to think about this after they already form a large part of the world economy, or they already form part of somebody's reserve somewhere. On the the inevitable question about Brexit, I think the IMF's position on Brexit has not changed a lot since before the vote when we published some research. I think we are of the view that Brexit will be a net economic loss for the UK and a net economic loss for the remaining countries in the EU. Having said that, there may be perfectly good political reasons to do that, and that's a sovereign choice of the UK. And there are also ways in which it can be done to minimize those losses. And certainly, greater clarity in the conditions and timing of Brexit would certainly help. And obviously, clarification about a close post-Brexit economic and financial relationship between the UK and the EU would also facilitate that process as well. And I think that's probably all I should probably say on that point. On the final question about external investment in Europe, that's a great question. The answer to your specific question about our research is we did not take into consideration the impact of external investment in this convergence research that we have done. And that's an interesting point, because it is true, in fact, that differentials in external investment in different countries could make a difference in convergence. Certainly, if you take the specific case of Ireland, external investment into Ireland was a huge driver of convergence in Ireland, where Ireland went from one of the poorest countries in the EU to one of the wealthiest. So that's a very fair point, and maybe in future research we'll have to think about that a little bit more.
Okay. Thank you very much for coming. Thank you for the interest, and I think we can all thank Mr. Franks for taking the time to talk about his research, and thank you for coming.